Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchuk. In this episode, we'll feature an interview with Joshua Brolier from the Chicago group Voices for Creative Nonviolence about the recent Gaza Freedom March in the Middle East. We'll also hear a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But now, here's the weekly program of Media and Democracy entitled Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
In a surge of last-minute activity, more than 19,000 comments, representing several hundred thousand individuals and hundreds of groups, were filed at the Federal Communications Commission last week prior to the deadline for initial comments on new network neutrality rules. Misty Perez-Trutzen is program manager of Free Press and the SaveTheInternet.com Coalition, an alliance of hundreds of groups dedicated to preserving net neutrality, the long-standing principle that prevents big phone and cable companies from discriminating against online content or applications.
The FCC received close to 200,000 comments, which is actually quite an amazing amount of comments in the docket. And a good, I would say the majority of those are from the public and their comments in favor of net neutrality rules, strong net neutrality protections. And so some of the most interesting comments that were in there were filed from individuals like you or I that were just going to the docket and inputting our thoughts on why an open internet is important to us, maybe important to us as a small business owner, a gamer, somebody who simply just likes to communicate with their friends and family online.
Comments were filed by a wide array of individuals, including engineers, musicians, scientists, artists, organizers, small businesses, residents of rural communities, and venture capitalists, to name a few. Perez-Trudson believes it's incredibly important for the public to engage in a process like this one and share personal stories with policymakers.
I think so many people did it because they care about the open internet. They recognize that the internet is the future of our communication system and we need to protect it. I think it's very easy when you explain to somebody what net neutrality is for them to grasp that, yeah, that's what I want for my internet experience. I want it to be open. I want to be able to access the websites and communicate with the folks that I care about and do what I want on the internet without having a gatekeeper.
To find out more about net neutrality, visit SaveTheInternet.com.
What kind of media behemoth would arise from the merger of Comcast and NBC Universal? In an open letter to President Obama and Congress, a group of industry, labor, and public interest organizations described a destructive giant that would harm smaller competitors and drive up prices for consumers. The organizations that signed the letter don't always see eye to eye, but groups like Common Cause and the Parents Television Council agree with the Writers Guild of America and Morality in Media that the merger will damage the media landscape and diminish diverse voices on TV. The American Cable Association also signed on to the letter. It represents nearly 900 small and rural cable companies across the country. Vice President Ross Lieberman says that Comcast and NBC currently compete to provide programming to cable companies. If the merger happens, much of that competition will disappear.
The fact that the USA Network won't be competing with E! Entertainment Network for programming and aren't competing to get eyeballs from our customers, they'll be able to join together and they'll be offered at the same time, and you won't have that competition that many times drives those costs lower.
And with increasing costs, the smaller cable providers aren't able to reinvest in their networks.
What ends up happening is they've left money left over to make investments, to upgrade their services, to roll out broadband deeper into their service areas, to further deploy the competitive telephone services, and in the worst case, pushes them out of business.
David Goodfriend, a satellite industry lobbyist and radio host, is concerned about Comcast's past behavior regarding sports programming. He's started sportsfanscoalition.org an alliance of groups concerned about access to sports on TV.
One of the most glaring examples of the sports media marketplace breaking down is in cities like Philadelphia, San Diego, New York, where the cable company also owns the local sports team and the local sports arena and the local sports network, and lo and behold tells you that the only way you can watch your local team is if you subscribe to cable, no other way. So we ask a logical question. If that's how Comcast plays in its own backyard, what happens when it owns NBC Sports?
Good Friend wants sports fans to understand media issues and have a voice in public policy matters in Washington.
Sports are like the canary in the coal mine. Everybody understands sports, enjoys sports, but when you find yourself less and less able to watch your favorite teams, that's an indicator of the media marketplace falling apart.
Comcast will be filing pre-merger papers with the Federal Communications Commission and the Department of Justice by the end of the month. Both the House and the Senate plan to hold hearings on the merger in the near future. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
The U.S. Supreme Court has given its approval to what was already an accomplished fact: corporate ownership of the governmental apparatus of the American state. In affirming that corporations have the right to buy as much influence as they can pay for with campaign contributions, the High Court has swept away the last remaining facade of America's Disney World democracy. The U.S. political system is revealed as nothing more than a theme park that offers the public fake election thrills that simulate one man, one vote. The barbaric principle underlying the decision was established 124 years ago when another Supreme Court ruled that corporations had the constitutional rights of persons. Like the recent ruling, the 1886 Supreme Court decision essentially ratified the emerging reality of the day. The corporations were already running the economy and government of the United States as if they owned it. It is said that more than half the U.S. senators own stock in the railroads, stock that had been given to them by the railroad corporations as gifts in return for millions of acres in federal lands. It was the age of the rise of the great robber barons who invented the modern corporation and demanded that their paper avatars be treated as full-fledged citizens of the republic. Dutifully, the Supreme Court complied, providing constitutional justification for already existing corporate rule. The current Supreme Court is simply expanding on the 1886 principle of corporate personhood to fit modern, much more expensive circumstances. The supremacy of corporate power in U.S. elections is a fait accompli, a manifest, self-evident fact. Only corporate persons, or actual human beings associated with corporations, could spend a total of $5.3 billion on the elections of 2008. Barack Obama himself received $650 million, the vast bulk of it from the corporate class, who gave more money to Democrats than to Republicans. The Democrats are complaining that the Supreme Court ruling will further advantage the Republicans. But the more profound effect will be to complete the corporatization of the Democratic Party, whose leadership is already at least as closely allied with Wall Street as the GOP. Remember, it was candidate Barack Obama who saved George Bush's bank bailout bill in 2008 and put Wall Street operatives at the helm of his new administration's economic policy. Wall Street is to the Democrats what big oil is to the Republicans, their sugar daddies. In response to the Supreme Court's damnable decision, more than 40,000 people have joined in support of a move to amend the U.S. Constitution, to once and forever proclaim that corporations are not people, only people are people, with the civil and political rights of human beings. Such a constitutional amendment is necessary to reverse not only the latest travesty from the Supreme Court, but the original sin of 1886, when corporations were recognized as persons. Those rulings created a legal construct in which the American people have no rights that a corporation is bound to respect. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. We now feature an interview with Joshua Brolier from the Chicago group Voices for Creative Nonviolence about the recent Gaza Freedom March in the Middle East. The following interview was recorded on Thursday, January 14th, 2010. We are joined on the phone by Joshua Brolier. Joshua is a co-coordinator with the Chicago-based activist group Voices for Creative Nonviolence, and he is also a member of the Catholic worker community in Chicago, and he'll be talking to us about the Gaza Freedom March. And Joshua, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mitchell.
So what is the Gaza Freedom March?
The idea for the Gaza Freedom March... It came out of several different places. It came out of international organizers, and it came out of Palestinians within Gaza. And the idea came together last year after Operation Catlett, which was a 22-day Israeli military assault on Gaza. And it was very devastating to the Palestinian people. Over 1,400 lives were lost, and then also much of the critical infrastructure in Gaza was destroyed. So the idea came together to do this march, which wouldn't commemorate the lives lost in Gaza, but not only that, the march was organized to try to highlight the siege and blockade of Gaza that's been imposed on the people there since 2006, and had been increasingly tightened since last year's Operation Catlett.
So what was the march about? You just marched into Gaza, or what happened?
So the general plan for the march was that there was planned for over 1,300 delegates from over 43 countries to come together in Cairo in Egypt, and we were going to go from Cairo to the Rafah border of Gaza and enter into Gaza and spend a couple days in Gaza meeting civil service organizations and organizers within Gaza and seeing what's going on in Palestine and in Gaza, and then after a couple days in Gaza, we were going to march together. On the 31st, on New Year's Eve, we were going to march together with 50,000 Palestinians to the Erez border with Israel. So the idea was to kind of have a Gandhian march that would which would challenge the siege of Gaza and push towards the border and demand that the Israelis open up the border. Unfortunately, not very much of that actually happened. A few days before the march was scheduled to start, all these delegates, the 1,300 international delegates, were scheduled to arrive in Cairo on the 27th of December. And a few days before that, the Egyptian government actually decided not to cooperate. They had been cooperating with the organizers for, you know, over 6 months of organizing, and a few days before said that we were not welcome and that we couldn't come as anything other than tourists. So it threw a big wrench in the whole plans of the Gaza March, and a lot of the march was contained in Egypt.
So what wound up happening, it sounds like, is you were in Egypt. You tried to march eastward into Gaza from Egypt. But yet, what happened? Did Egypt just stop you at the border? Did the Israeli soldiers do anything here? What was there a showdown of some kind?
So a lot of different things happened, but as the delegates were coming in from different places, there were people from, you know, all over the world coming. We had people from South Africa, France, Canada, Libya, Jordan, all these different people are coming in. The Egyptian government ruled that any meeting that we had of over six people was illegal, so we weren't allowed to meet in public. So here we have all these people coming who have reservations at hotels, and we have an orientation scheduled and planning meetings, but all these meetings have been deemed illegal. So every time we attempted to get together, we were basically surrounded by riot police, fenced off with barricades, and pushed into smaller and smaller places. So as we saw that this was happening, you know, I don't know that there was too much of a plan B planned, because the Egyptian government had seemed so friendly up until the point of the march. But still, as people came together, we met in small groups, and we actually did hold a number of demonstrations there in Egypt to protest what was going on, all of which were met with, you know, immediate reaction by, you know, scores of police. But we held a demonstration at the United Nations building at the World Trade Center in Cairo. We held a demonstration with Egyptians at the Egyptian Journalism Syndicate, which was a really large and lively demonstration. Some of the different delegations took different approaches. In fact, the French delegation, they made an encampment in front of their embassy. Over 300 French occupied their embassy for over 6 days. There's a group of, actually, the American delegation was 750 strong, and at one point when the Americans, some of us attempted to go to our embassy to seek support for the Gaza March, we were actually detained by Egyptian police on the premises of the American embassy and rounded into circles and forcibly detained for several hours. So we received absolutely no support from the U.S. embassy at all, But there were smaller demonstrations and some larger ones, but many people were attempting to get to Gaza on their own, not as the whole march, but all these people were being turned back. The Egyptian government revoked all the buses we had, both public and private. So even private buses were being stopped at all the borders and checkpoints and sent back to Cairo. So there was a full blockade for some time that people weren't able to make it.
Do you know why the Egyptian government, who previously had been acting in apparently good faith with negotiations for so long, suddenly turned around and became super antagonistic?
You know, they have been acting in good faith, and that doesn't mean that they necessarily had been the easiest to cooperate with, but they had been at least, you know, saying that things were going to go forward. But I think that it seemed very obvious, actually, that the Israelis and that, you know, the United States put pressure on Egypt not to allow the march to happen. Right now, Egypt is the second largest recipient of American military aid, second only to Israel. So you kind of have this triple alliance, you know, right there in the Middle East surrounding Gaza, between Israel, the U.S., and Egypt. And I think that, you know, obviously Israel didn't want this march to happen. They didn't want the bad press. They didn't want the world to be reminded of what happened last year during Operation Katla, and they didn't want the world to see what's going on a daily basis in Gaza. So I think that, you know, whichever way it came, whether it was Israel or the United States who applied the pressure, it was certainly applied, and probably from both angles. And once that word went out, Egypt was not willing to back down.
This could be a segue to some of the larger issues. You've talked about that stopping the march was kind of critical to keeping a lid on some of the things that had happened in Kasled and it's going on in Israel and the occupied territories. Could you talk about some of the things that have been going on? Admittedly, I'm asking you to cover a lot in just a few minutes, but tell us a little bit more about the history and the current circumstances that are going on in that area of the world.
Well, just to give a small background of what's going on with the actual siege of Gaza, the siege was really implemented in somewhat close to its current form back in 2006, after Hamas was democratically elected in Gaza, and then the United States and Israel got together and kind of, you know, backed an opposing party to oust Hamas, and then they reinstated themselves militarily. But since Hamas has taken power in Gaza, Israel has implemented a tighter and tighter blockade, allowing all kinds of essential goods, medicines, materials for building, basic construction, and not only that, but even, you know, staples of food and water are at times limited. And so this blockade has become tighter and tighter, and it's not only about goods and commodities, but also about restrictions of travel. People in Gaza are not allowed to, they're not allowed to leave whenever they want to. They're basically trapped in what many have described as the largest open-air prison in the world. So there is a border crossing with Egypt. Very rarely, and very, it seems, arbitrarily, are people allowed to come in and out. But so these are the conditions that the Gazans have been facing. And then on top of that, as we started off the conversation talking about last year's Operation Kasled, where the Israeli military for 22 straight days just bombarded Gaza in both an air war and a ground war, which
know, was completely one-sided. I mean, there was 1,400 Palestinians that were killed and 13 Israelis that were killed. I believe some, I want to say 6 or 8 of whom were killed from friendly fire. But, you know, this was a collective punishment on the population of Gaza for having Hamas as a government, as a governing power. So that's kind of the greater context, but also, you know, as far as the siege is concerned, Egypt has been playing a very active role in this and is colluding with the United States. You know, Egypt and the United States are now building an underground wall at the Rafah border of Gaza with the intended, with the given intention is to stop smuggling of arms into Gaza, but there are tunnels that are built under the Rafah border, which are used for humanitarian aid and basically are a lifeline for the people of Gaza. No doubt that some weapons are smuggled through. But when contrasted with the amount of military aid and weapons that are shipped into Israel by the United States, these tunnels are absolutely nothing in comparison. There's a few archaic rockets that are able to make it through.
Let's go back to some of the basics about your trip there. Tell us about what your involvement was in the Gaza Freedom March. What did you do? How were you involved?
Well, I heard about the march several months before it happened, so I wasn't in on any of the major organizing as far as the march was concerned. But maybe I'll just go back to the story of actually the main day of the march. And the day that the march was scheduled to happen on New Year's Eve, even though we were stuck there in Cairo and we had already held many demonstrations and without success, we decided we would still go ahead and try to march. We got in small groups and brainstormed, and we came up with the idea that we were going to try to do the Gaza Freedom March in Cairo in the same sense, in a Gandhian sense. We were going to push forward no matter what the authorities brought to us. So we planned this march, and we all had to come together clandestinely in Tahrir Square, which is one of the main squares in downtown Cairo. We came in groups of 2 or 3 small groups and pretended to be tourists. And at a certain point, about 10 a.m., one of the organizers waved the flag, and we all converged together in Tahrir Square. And from that point, attempted to symbolically start marching towards Gaza. Basically, at that point, kind of all hell broke loose, and there was a lot of chaos because the Egyptian police immediately sent hundreds of police to the scene and surrounded us with riot cops. But worse than riot cops, there was undercover secret police who came in and just started beating protesters mercilessly. There were people of all sorts being grabbed by the hair, punched in the face, kicked and dragged, and to be forcibly removed from the street. So I was a part of that, and that actually happened to me. I myself was punched in the face. I was kicked in the back. My glasses were broken, and I pulled my hair and dragged, and was forcibly removed from the square. And after that happened, though, we were able to hold down a space there for 6 hours in downtown Egypt in opposition. Before we voted and we decided to disperse.
It doesn't sound like that you got arrested. Were you arrested?
No, you know, from what I've heard, there was no one arrested that was part of the international delegation. And I think that the Egyptian government had the screws put to them by the U.S. and Israel, but I think they were doing everything they could to avoid bad press. So I think they were sending to us as demonstrators a strong message that we weren't going to be allowed to do what we wanted to do, but I think that they were doing everything they could to avoid arresting us or deporting us, which is what, in my mind, I kind of came prepared thinking that, well, this may very well happen. That was almost the first thing I thought would happen, but I think that they did everything they could to not allow that to happen. Though, conversely, I think that some Egyptians did fare worse than the internationals, and, as is well known, there's not a culture of protest. Let me not say not a culture of protest, but protests in Egypt are always met with force of the government, and any public protest that's done in opposition to the government, demonstrators are dragged away and often tortured. And despite the fact there were many Egyptians that joined in with us in these protests in solidarity with Palestine. And, you know, many of them were being followed home. Many of them were pulled out of our crowd. If there was a person in our protest that looked to be Egyptian, the cops would just come up and basically grab them and drag them out. So, I myself was not arrested, but I think that other people there had it worse off.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the Chicago connections to the Gaza Freedom March. Obviously, you live in Chicago, and you were involved. And you also mentioned that it was a very sizable American delegation. Any idea of the number of Chicagoans or Chicago's involvement in the Gaza Freedom March?
Sure. I think the Chicago delegation was somewhere from 12 to 14. And though smaller in number than some other delegations, everybody was joking once we got there that we'd become our own country. We had some really wonderful people with us. Ali Abunima was with us. He's a professor at the University of Chicago, and he's also the co-founder of Electronic Intifada, which is a very prominent website reporting on issues in Palestine. There was also a couple people from the Jewish Anti-Zionist Network. Jeff Pickard from the International Solidarity Movement. Dana and Laura Elborno were with us. They're two sisters of Palestinian descent that live in Chicago and are part of the Palestinian Solidarity group. And then also Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers were with us as well, among others. I think that, like I said, there was probably 12 to 14 of us there.
What does the future hold for the efforts that were organizing the Gaza Freedom March? Obviously, this attempt kind of got stymied for understandable reasons. Are there plans to reprise it, or what's the future store?
Sure. Yeah, and I know much of this interview, it sounded sort of bleak, the picture of what happened there, and in a lot of ways it was, but I also want to emphasize that there was, you know, I really found great strength and courage among the protesters that came there. I mean, many people came together with such common purpose and intention, and there was really a strong sense of momentum. And despite the fact that we were held there in Cairo, there was a huge media presence and media attention on what's going on. Now, I know in the United States it didn't get reported quite as much, but internationally there was a huge focus on Gaza because of the march, and I think it's quite a different focus than what was going on last year as Gaza was being bombarded by Israel. But I think some of the things that came out of it were that people were kind of re-energized in their commitment to work to break the siege, and one of the main ways that people were promoting through something that came out as the Cairo Declaration was kind of trying to re-energize the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. And throughout the march, a lot of talk of this was really headed up by the South African delegation that really saw the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement work in South Africa. So they're really promoting this and talking about doing an international speaking tour to really encourage people to develop local campaigns that really target people that are either profiting off of business in the occupied territories or also profiting off of war making in Palestine. So there's a lot of talk of that, and there was also a lot of talk about future direct actions, and I wouldn't be surprised if something comes together again, trying to draw from the same delegates and bringing in even more, and I'm not sure from what angle, but we had some meetings with Egyptian activists who were very very excited and very much thinking about planning protests in opposition to the underground wall that the United States and Egypt are building to close off the Rafah border. Yeah, and I think that people are throwing around a lot of ideas, and like I said before, there's a lot of momentum, so I hope to see something come out of this that will bring us all back together again.
And the last question, this is probably even more to ask for in maybe just a minute or two, but could you explain a little bit about how you got interested and involved in not only the Gaza Freedom March, but on this issue generally?
Yeah, I think I started looking in a little bit closer to what was going on in Palestine, really per the suggestion of a professor that I had in college, and he was a professor of South African history, and he also taught a class on Zimbabwe that I took. But, having known that South African history and then also you know, also understanding international movements, he kind of pointed to the situation in Palestine and really told us how it was very similar to apartheid. So I did some reading about it in college, but I think one of the things that has affected me since I moved to Chicago that really moved me towards doing activism concerning Palestine is having spent the last year at the Catholic Worker House in Chicago, which is a house that provides housing for, it's a house of hospitality and provides housing for people who are homeless and oftentimes refugees. So I spent the last year living with a man from Palestine and just became a good friend, and just his generosity and spirit was so overwhelmingly positive. It was just a great relationship, and you know, I think a lot of times when you meet someone from another country, it really personalizes the issue. But and I also work with Voices for Creative Nonviolence, and we've been working to oppose U.S. militarism in general in Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan, and one of the proxy wars that we're fighting is in Palestine by the amount of, you know, $3.5 billion of military aid that we send to Israel every year. So just all those factors combined are what compelled me to take part in the march and to continue in the struggle.
We've been speaking with Joshua Brolier. He is a co-coordinator of VCNV, Voices for Creative Nonviolence, a member of the Catholic Worker Community in Chicago, and was also a participant in the Gaza Freedom March, and has been speaking with us about that. Joshua, thank you so much for joining us.
All right, thanks for having me, Mitchell.
That was an interview with Joshua Brolier, recorded on January 14, 2010. To learn more about Voices for Creative Nonviolence, go online to www.vcnv.org. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.